And this morning we're carrying on where we left off last Sunday, which was in the middle of Matthew's Gospel, Matthew chapter 13, which you'll find in page 1020 of the Church Bibles, and there'll be a Church Bible underneath the seat that you're sitting on, or the seat in front of you, and if you haven't got one and can't find one, then if you ask someone else who's been here before, then they will find it for you. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 13, on page 20. Last week we read the parable of the sower, and Jesus not only explained why or what the parable of the sower meant, he also explained why he was speaking in parables. And then he goes on in the rest of the chapter to tell six more parables, three of which we're going to look at this morning: the parable of the weeds, the parable of the yeast, and the parable of the mustard seed, and three of which we'll go on, I hope, to look at next Sunday. But just before we read any one of these parables, let's just focus a bit on what is going on here. These parables of the kingdom, what are they about? What is the purpose or the big picture that Jesus is trying to get across to us? We began this morning by thinking about the Exodus. And you know where that ends if you've read the story before. If not, the E100 readings will take you there over the next couple of weeks. It ends with Joshua leading the people of Israel into a land flowing with milk and honey. They crossed the River Jordan and arrived in the land. And no doubt, as some of the people were crossing the river, they were already reaching into their rucksacks for their milk jugs and their honey pots. Because they thought they'd arrived. They thought they were home and dry, quite literally, after they'd crossed the Jordan. But Joshua then said to them, in effect, instead of reaching for your milk jugs and honey pots, you need to reach for your swords and your spears. Because although you have arrived in the promised land, now you've got to fight for it. Now we've got to establish the people of Israel in this place. And in just the same way, when King Jesus came to earth, there were some people who thought the hard work was done, who thought it was milk jug and honey pot time. Relax and enjoy yourself, because the king had come. But just as in the Exodus, where the cross frees us from slavery to sin, instead of being able to say, that's it, all the hard work is over, what Jesus is saying now, the battle begins. And what the parables of the kingdom that we're about to read will show us is a kingdom that doesn't arrive all at once with a bang, cross, resurrection, everything complete, but rather a kingdom that starts from a small beginning and grows like a field full of wheat or a mustard seed or a batch of dough rising. And Jesus is describing a growth which began 2,000 years ago when the Son of Man came to sow the good seed, and will carry on until the end of time when the Son of Man returns to gather in his harvest. And it's important that we understand that, because if we don't, then as we look around us and try to live our Christian life, we'll make one of two mistakes. Either we will expect too little. We'll believe the kingdom of God is not up to much. It will always be small. It will always be struggling. And we won't expect things to change. We won't work for change. We won't pray for change. And all we'll ever ask God to do is to compensate us in our sadness and our weakness and our loss. That's what theologians call under-realized eschatology. Eschatology is the technical term for things being sorted out, for the end coming. And under-realized eschatology is when we don't realize how much has already happened. We don't expect the kingdom to grow at all. But if we don't make that mistake, we're in danger of making the opposite mistake of expecting too much, of believing that God's invincible kingdom is already complete, that the church can never be stopped in its tracks, and as a result, then we'll be ill-equipped for life's struggles and tears. That's what's called over-realized eschatology. We're getting ahead of ourselves. We're getting too big for our boots. We're heading for a fall. And Jesus wants us to know where we really are. Still with a long way to go, but always making progress under God towards his planned conclusion. So that anything is possible, but nothing is guaranteed. And if we understand that, then we're keeping pace with God. Now look ahead to verse 34, where it says that Jesus used parables to tell all these things to the crowd. He wouldn't say a thing to them without using a parable. And he did this to make what the prophet had said come true. And the prophet had said in one of the Psalms, I will use parables when I speak to them. I will tell them things unknown since the creation of the world. So Jesus used parables, paints pictures to describe the situation in which they find himself. And you can understand why that is, because his death and resurrection, even for us today with the benefits of faith and the benefit of hindsight, are hard things to understand, hard things to put into words and explain what difference they make or why they happened. And it was even harder at the time of Matthew chapter 13, because his death and resurrection hadn't taken place. So Jesus paints these word pictures instead of simply laying down the facts. And that was necessary, because if in Matthew chapter 13 Jesus had come and said, you know, I'm the King of heaven and I can do whatever I want, then all of them would have looked and seen a Galilean carpenter and laughed at his delusions and written him off and forgotten about him. But by the same token, if he'd said nothing in Matthew chapter 13, then by the time we get to Matthew chapter 28, when Jesus has risen from the dead and those who believe in him do know that he is the king and can do anything that he wants, if he hadn't told those stories, they would have been saying, come on, Jesus, what are you waiting for? Why hasn't the kingdom come? But by planting these pictures now like time bombs in their memories, bombs that Jesus is able to explode into meaning once they realize who he is, Jesus is preparing them and us for the growth of his kingdom that was still to come. So he's telling them things in verse 35 that were unknown since the creation of the world. They had no previous experience of what he was telling them, so he had nothing to relate it to directly. And so he says the kingdom is like things that you do recognize. Like the fields full of corn that you pass every day. Like the mustard bush growing in the garden that you hear the birds singing in every evening. Like the homemade bread you eat at every meal. And what he was doing was attaching his kingdom to these everyday images, so that everywhere they looked and everywhere they went, whenever they went for a walk or sat in the garden or had a meal, they would think of Jesus in the kingdom of heaven. And it wouldn't be something that's happening beyond their experience, but something that was a part of their daily lives. Maybe not always understood, but nevertheless something they knew was always going on. And I really do think that if Jesus was here today, he would say the kingdom of heaven is like this. It's like a block of flats being built. It's like a football crowd gathering. It's like a petrol tank being filled at the pump. Things that we do every day and recognize and are part of our lives, so that whenever we saw them again as we walked around the streets, we would be thinking, kingdom of God, kingdom of heaven, Jesus the King. And not a day would pass or an hour or a moment without us imagining each of these things as windows into heaven where we can see the kingdom growing. So Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is this. Let's read the first of the parables in verse 34. The kingdom of heaven is like this. A man sowed good seed in his field. But one night when everyone was asleep, an enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. And when the plants grew and the ears of corn began to form, then the weeds showed up. And the man's servants came to him and said, Sir, it was good seed you sowed in your field. So where did the weeds come from? it was some enemy who did this, he answered. So do you want us to go and pull up the weeds, they asked him? No, he answered, because as you gather the weeds, you might pull up some of the wheat along with them. So let the wheat and the weeds both grow together until harvest, and then I will tell the harvest workers to pull up the weeds first and tie them in bundles and burn them, and then to gather in the wheat and put it in my barn. Amen. And I pray that God will help us in due course to understand this parable. So we come to the parable of the weeds. There is apparently a weed called darnel, which looks very like wheat when it starts to grow, but unlike wheat, produces no harvest. And it grows wild, and farmers very often have to pull a few clumps of darnel out of their wheat fields. But in this story we have, in Matthew chapter 13, the weed was so widespread that the farm workers despaired. They knew that the seed they had sown was good, and therefore, with the guidance of the owner, they recognize that they have been victims of sabotage. And that was a story the folks in Jesus' time would have related to. It was a common enough crime for the Romans to have drafted a specific law against it. But it's not just a story about the injustices of agricultural practice, of course, because in verse 37 and 8 we'll go on to see that in this passage the farmer represents Jesus, the Son of Man. His field represents the world, that's everybody. The wheat is the people who belong to Jesus, defined as God's people, or those who belong to the kingdom. And the weeds, the darnel, is the people who belong to the evil one, the enemy, who comes and sows the crop at night. And the kind of questions we might ask about the situation Jesus is describing, therefore, is where does this evil come from? Would be the first question. And the second question might be, what is God going to do about it? And Jesus is very clear that the evil comes from an enemy, the devil, who was never a part of God's perfect plan. The farmer didn't want to have weeds in the midst of his field, but it's an outside intervention, a spoiling technique. And that is simply all the devil ever does. He uses people. And the explanation of the parable in verse 41 shows that Jesus is thinking here both of the people who do evil things and of those who cause others to sin. But the devil's plan is to take these people and use them to get at Jesus. And that's important for us to realize. Sometimes we have a picture in our mind, and it appears in stories and songs and other places. We have a picture in our mind in which Jesus and the devil are fighting a battle over us, and we are the prize. As if both the devil and Jesus prized us equally and wanted to pull us, to attract us into their kingdom. But that's actually not true. It's only half true. As this parable makes clear, Jesus is fighting for us. He desperately wants to have us in his kingdom. That's what the seed was sown for. That's why the farmer was a farmer. Jesus wants us, but the devil isn't interested in us at all. As far as he is concerned, he only wants to take advantage of us, to exploit us, to use us as his cannon fodder, if you like, to fire at Jesus, or as the weeds to sow in Jesus' field. And that's important to remember, because sometimes people, particularly educated people, think of themselves as liberated from anything to do with Jesus. I've grown out of that, they will say. I have put behind me the superstition of faith, which used to captivate my thinking. I have grown out of the ignorance of religion, that childish pagan idea. I have escaped from the manipulation of the church, which is only trying to control me for its own ends. And the truth is, as this parable explains to us, that these people who are so proud of being free are actually the unwitting pawns of the devil. That he is using and abusing them in an unscrupulous way, and all the devil ever does is grow weeds. That's the best he can produce. So where Jesus sacrifices himself for us, the devil simply sacrifices his people. And when Jesus' plan to build a future and a hope and to produce growth towards a harvest, the devil's only hope is to lay waste to what Jesus is doing, to undo what Jesus has done. Can't create anything for himself, can only measure success in terms of someone else's work that he has pulled down. A builder or a demolisher? Who is the greatest artist? Someone who paints a picture or someone who slashes it with a knife? Who is the more skilled? Whose handiwork would you rather be? But Jesus protects us from these evil schemes. That's really the purpose of this parable. Folks would be wondering why things weren't moving on as quickly as they wanted and why they were still at risk or at the mercy of people who were dead set against Jesus. And Jesus says here, I will protect you. Strangely enough, by letting things be. Because where we would have sided with the farm workers, perhaps, and said, let's uproot the weeds and get rid of them so that the wheat has room to flourish, Jesus says, no, leave the weeds be. And the reason he says that is to protect the wheat, because he can see that below the surface, in verse 29, the roots of the weeds and the wheat are intertwined. So any weed pulled up now, before the harvest is ripe, might pull up some wheat with it. An unripe wheat is worthless. It too could only be thrown on the fire. And there is not a single one of his chosen ones whose potential ripeness Jesus doesn't want to see fulfilled. So where we'd like Jesus to come along and uproot all the evil around about us, to do away with poverty and put an end to crime and heal every sickness and overcome corruption and scale down bankers' bonuses and remove the litter problem in the streets and you can add to the list whatever your own particular bugbear is. And say to Jesus, if he'd only come and take this out of the world now, it'd be so much of a better place. Jesus says, no, I don't want to do that yet. And the reason why I don't want to do it is because you're not yet ripe for heaven. And I want to protect you until you're fully grown, until you're ready, and not pull you up too soon. And Peter, who would have been one of the disciples who sat and listened to that, later on wrote a letter to the church which perhaps had this in mind when he said in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 7, that the many kinds of trial that you are suffering from are there to refine your faith like gold in a fire. Jesus realized you could not rid the world of evil without getting rid of evil people. And then he sees the lives of his people intertwined with theirs, so he leaves them all where they are to give us time to get ready for him. And even during that time, even in a sin-sick world, faith is being nourished, the wheat is growing, the harvest is coming. So Jesus says in verse 30, let the wheat and the weeds both grow together. And in that decision of Jesus, there is grounds for tremendous confidence. Do you understand what it is? Do you see what the farmer, with all his experience of growing crops, anticipates? he anticipates that the weeds and the wheat can be left growing side by side, and the weeds won't do the wheat any harm. They can grow side by side, and for a lot of the time you might not even be able to tell the difference between them, but come harvest time, the weeds will not have done the wheat any harm. That's what Jesus is saying here, that evil cannot harm us. It can be beside us, it can get in between us, but come harvest time it will have cost us nothing. And the reason for that is because the seed that Jesus has sowed was good. And the reason for that is because the soil in which the seed takes root is good. So that come what may, Jesus has already done enough to gather in a harvest. No amount of neighboring evil can spoil it. So where Christian people are sometimes tempted to do their own weeding by separating themselves into Christian communities where people they think of as evil are excluded, to have only Christian friends or to see the church as a fortress in which they hide, Jesus says, no, be mixed together. Confident not only that we are safe, which is what this parable tells us, but also that we have a part to play or a difference to make within his kingdom in the time that remains. And that's what the following two parables are about. So let's look at what it says in verse 31 to 33. Jesus told them another parable and said, the kingdom of heaven is like this. A man takes a mustard seed and sows it in his field. It's the smallest of all the seeds, but when it grows up, it's the biggest of all the plants. Mustard bushes grow to about 12 or 15 feet tall. So if they were in a vegetable garden, which is where you'd plant a mustard seed, they would fairly dwarf the cabbages and the parsley. It's the smallest of all the seed, but when it grows up, it's the biggest of all the plants. It becomes a tree, so that birds come and make their nests in its branches. And Jesus told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like this. A woman takes some yeast and mixes it with 40 liters of flour until the whole batch of dough rises. The kingdom of heaven is growing, Jesus is saying. But what I want you to notice as we think about these two parables is this, first of all, that Jesus does not say the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. He doesn't say that. And he doesn't say the kingdom of heaven is like yeast. What he says is the kingdom of heaven is like this. And then he paints a whole picture. And the picture is of the mustard seed becoming a tree in a garden surrounded by all sorts of plants and inhabited by birds. And the picture is of the woman mixing yeast into 20 bags of flour to make a huge batch of dough. The seed and the yeast together represent God's people, but the kingdom includes everything, the world of which the people are just one part. Just as in the previous parable, the kingdom of heaven was not just the wheat, but the field. The wheat and the weeds growing side by side, and even the enemy who sowed them, were all part of what Jesus said the kingdom of heaven is like. Because all of them were ultimately under Jesus' authority and subject to the king's rule. So the kingdom of heaven is like this, says Jesus, a garden in which the mustard seed is planted. And the mustard seed represents the people of God, and it grows from a seed that would be too small to see if I held it up this morning between my thumb and my finger, but it becomes such a large bush that you could call it a tree. And the birds would come and build their nests in its branches. Jesus is painting a picture here that resembles one that Ezekiel the prophet painted in Ezekiel chapter 31, and the other prophet Daniel in Daniel chapter 4. They painted pictures of the empires of Egypt and Babylon and described them as trees, mighty trees, and birds representing the smaller nations came and made their nests in the branches. And what Jesus is doing now is updating that picture by replacing failed political power with the church and saying the people of God need to be outstanding in the world as a place of refuge, distinctive but also accessible, attractive as a place where a nest could be built, and accepting of people as they come. But then he also says in the second parable that the people of God, the church, are like the yeast worked into the dough, kneaded and kneaded so that every part of the dough has some yeast in it and is subject to the influence of the yeast. If you've ever done bread making, you'll know that the yeast is just a tiny proportion of the ingredients. Half a pint of water, 2 cups of flour, and a teaspoon of yeast is what you use, with some oil as well and some sugar. So little you sometimes miss the yeast out and it doesn't work. I've tried it. So it's a tiny proportion of the ingredients, perhaps a small a proportion of the population as the presence of evangelical Christians in Scotland today. But Jesus says that doesn't matter, because the whole batch can still be made to rise with the presence of a tiny proportion of yeast. And what he's really saying here is that no part of the world's population, not the rich or the poor, not the urban or the rural, not the old or the young, not the single or the married, not the straight or the gay, that no area of life in which all these people live, neither industry or entertainment or healthcare or education or music or painting or science or technology or war or peace or leisure or employment or anything else that you could think of, should be outside the influence of God's people. Because it's all ultimately under God's authority. And in all of these areas, God's people should be present, making their presence felt. So nowhere and no one is off limits for Christian witness. When we're handing out our flyers for outreach events, we shouldn't be putting them in coffee shops but missing out the pubs, thinking drinkers will not come to this, but coffee shop people might. Nowhere should be devoid of Christian influence, just as none of the dough is yeast-free. If you don't knead the bread properly, then again, the loaf just doesn't taste right. So no Christian ever needs to say, I'd better stop what I'm doing. I'm in the wrong place to serve God. No Christian should ever need to start by saying that. I need to change my job or abandon my hobby or find something more worthwhile to do with my time or make new friends or go overseas to find a mission field. What we should say is, what does God want me to do here and now? Because if I leave these friends, or give up this way of spending my time, or move to another part of the world, then God will just need to find somebody else to move in to take our place. So the question is, how can I do my job for Jesus? How can my hospital ward, my university lecture theatre, my shop that I sell papers in, my office where I answer the telephone, my house where delivery men come and visitors as well, my whatever you like. How can that place, how can Jesus be nourished there? How can he be seen? How can his presence, his influence be felt? How can I show Jesus to my friends, my clients, my colleagues, and my boss? Do you begin to see what the kingdom of heaven is like? We sometimes think of heaven as a shining place, all decked out in gold, while the only thing that anybody ever does is sing psalms of praise. But it's not. Jesus says, this is what the kingdom of heaven is like. It's messy, like a field full of wheat with weeds growing in it. But it's also a place where the church must stand out, like the mustard tree is a place of refuge to which people can come. But it's also a place where the people of God are the hidden and active ingredient worked into every aspect of society, like the yeast in the dough. And in that kingdom, the people of God are safe within the world because evil can't harm them, and are a refuge from the world because people will come to them, and are an influence in the world. And that is how it is right now, and that is what is going on. But that, of course, is not how it will end. And we still have Jesus' explanation of the parable of the weeds to come, with its emphasis on the harvest. But before we go on and look at that, we're going to sing again. And we're going to sing, it's actually one of the songs, one of the psalms, but what it does is picks up on the idea of the people of God as themselves in receipt of a blessing and protection, but also able to offer blessing and protection to others. Father in heaven, we thank you that we know that your kingdom is growing and will never end. And as we commit ourselves to the life and work of that kingdom building process, we ask that you would bless the gifts we have given today and at other times and in other ways, and the work of which we are a part. And bless your whole world in which you reign supreme. And bless those countries where there is struggle and turmoil, like Egypt at the moment. And bless our land where good and evil live side by side. And help us to be secure in the strength and the safety that you provide for us to play the part which you have given us. In Jesus Christ our Lord. Let's look at this explanation of the parable of the weeds. I think we spent too much time cuddling each other this morning, so we're going to run over a little time, but I hope your chicken doesn't get burnt. And if you are going home to make bread, include salt as well, because I think I missed that out earlier. Verse 36, when Jesus had left the crowd and gone indoors, his disciples came to him and said, "Tell us what the parable about the weeds in the field means." And Jesus answered, "The man who sowed the seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed is the people who belong to the kingdom, and the weeds are the people who belong to the evil one. And the enemy who sowed the weeds is the devil. And the harvest is the end of the age, and the harvest workers are angels. And just as the weeds are gathered up and burnt in the fire, so the same thing will happen at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels to gather up out of his kingdom all those who cause people to sin and all others who do evil things. And they will throw them into the fiery furnace where they will cry and grind their teeth. And then God's people will shine like the sun in their Father's kingdom. Listen then, if you have ears." Amen. I want you to notice this, if you can count, that in the parable that he told, Jesus uses most of the seven verses from 24 to 30, uses most of the seven verses to describe the process of sowing and growing, with only one verse right at the end to describe the harvest. But in the explanation of the parable that he gives us, sowing and growing get only two verses. And all the rest, the other five, describe the harvest, with three of those five describing the weeding out and the burning up of the evil people, of those who cause people to sin, and all others who do evil things. This is hellfire and judgment. And it's quite clear where Jesus' main emphasis in the parable lies. That's what he's talking about. Count the words. And it's quite clear that the people he has in mind will not end up as part of his kingdom. And if you don't believe that, if you believe that somehow at the end of the day God will include everybody and everybody will be forgiven and saved, or people from all sorts of different faith backgrounds will all end up living happily ever after together, if you believe anything like that, then you're not believing what Jesus teaches. What Jesus makes very plain here, and what you're rejecting, is not narrow-minded fundamentalism or overzealous self-righteous preaching, but the clear picture which Jesus drew of the time to come. That while the kingdom of heaven consists for now of good and bad mixed up together and work and witness for Christians to do, and while we may all prefer to see ourselves as a mixture of good and bad, perhaps as shades of grey, with no clear distinction between right and wrong, that is not how it will end. Because ultimately God's people, in verse 42, who are defined not in terms of what they have done, it's not that good people will be saved, but are defined in terms of who they belong to, those who belong to the kingdom of heaven. They will be left standing alone when all the rest have gone. And it doesn't need much more emphasis than that. It doesn't need more time, because Jesus has said it. But the reason why he says it now is this, because he's talking to people who will need to understand that the ongoing labor of kingdom building in a sin-sick world is not a fruitless task. That if you are a wheat stalk surrounded by weeds, you might not be able to see another wheat stalk because the weeds are so thick at times. But that's not where it will end. And if you live in a field surrounded by weeds, then you might think of yourself as a weed-like person, worthless and tainted and no better than anyone else. But that's not how it is, because the picture that we are shown of the end of time when the weeding has been done is beautiful. What Jesus says in verse 42 is this, that then God's people will shine like the sun in their Father's kingdom. And what I think Jesus is picturing here is that wheat field at harvest time. Have you seen the field of golden corn? Maybe sometime in the autumn when you're out driving in the countryside and the wind is blowing across the field and it's all swaying from side to side and it's basking in the heat of the sun. And it looks just like a field of gold. More golden than it really is, because it reflects the sun's rays. And Jesus is saying it's beautiful. It's a field of which any owner, any farmer would be proud. Do you see what he's not saying? He's not saying you will be a dirty, worthless, sin-sick person until the end of time comes, and then Jesus will transform you into something beautiful. He is saying that when that time comes, he will show us how beautiful we are by weeding out the evil from around us so that only what is perfect remains. And when that time comes, we will see. We will see what it means to belong to Jesus. We will see what we have become. And a field that passers-by the day before would have dismissed as wasteland, and on which most owners would have given up in despair because it was so thick with weeds and more bother than it would be worth to harvest, that field ends up radiating its own and reflecting the sun's glory. And that will be us if we belong to Jesus. And when it happens, although it would be wonderful, we shouldn't be surprised. In fact, we should be looking forward to it and glowing with his reflected pride now, because we are the results of his labor. We are sown with his seed. We are grown in his land. And we are waiting to be plucked by an angel. And we might not be able to see it yet because of the thickness of the weeds that surround us, but we can see it here in the picture that Jesus draws, and we can hear it in his words. And Jesus says, if you have ears, then listen.